The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
The Incomparable, number 601, February 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. In this episode, we're going to be talking about The Expanse. Now, we're going to be talking about two kinds of The Expanse, but they're both the end of The Expanse. We're going to be talking about season 6 of the TV show The Expanse on Prime Video, which is the supposedly last season of the TV show The Expanse. I have questions. We are also going to then talk about the 9th book in the book series of The Expanse, Leviathan Falls, which came out recently, in order to, we'll fire off a spoiler horn. So if you've only seen the show and haven't read the books, just listen to the first part. And if you've only read the books and haven't seen the show, I mean, listen anyway. You already know what happens. It was like 3 books ago. So we're going to be introducing our panelists, some of whom will have to leave us because they have not read the books. Those people yet. And those people are, in fact, co-hosts of A Legitimate Salvage here on The Incomparable, the podcast that's all about The Expanse. And I'll introduce them to you now because then they will be leaving us sooner than the others. Chip Sutter is here. Hello.
Go into a room too fast, kid. The room eats you. I know that's an older quote, but I had to.
Doors and Corners. Jen Burt is also here. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if we're going to have to trigger the ring entity is here.
Just got to pick up enough speed. You got to do a little... put a little body English into it and boom, you can eat spaceships with that. And then people who've read the books and will not be spaced later in this podcast. Dan Morin, hello.
6 seasons in a movie.
Well, minus the movie.
Okay.
I'm down with that.
And Aline Sims.
I don't have a clever quote, but I'm glad I'm not going to be spaced.
That not spaced. I mean, like, I guess we all are spaced at the end, but
you got that going for you.
Man. It's only implied.
Looks awful.
Yeah, it doesn't look good at all. Poor David Strathairn. I'm still sad about him. But then again, what Jared Harris just died off screen.
So. Poor Jared Harris.
He's too expensive.
He's doing all right.
He's in space in the far future.
So. That's right. He had to go back to his home planet. It's okay. So season 6 of The Expanse, surprising in a bunch of ways. Only 6 episodes, which felt a little bit short. This is a show that, remember, they took a season and a half in order to tell the story of the first book in the series. And now here at the end, instead of sort of lavishly portraying everything that happens in book 6 of this series, we're done in 6 episodes. And on top of it, the decision to adapt Strange Dogs, which is one of the novellas outside the novel series, that is primarily a preview of the 7th, 8th, and 9th books of the series, which are apparently not going to be adapted by the Expanse TV show, which ended. I thought I would just start with the big question there. How do all of you feel about the length of this series, this season, and the adaptation here? For those who've read the books, you could throw that in about book 6 and the inclusion of the Laconia subplot that opened every single episode, which isn't even in book 6.
I think I could sum up maybe all of our feelings with just the 3 letters WTF.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
I don't know. Obviously, I'm not privy to any of the behind the scenes information about why the production went in the direction that it did. It surprises me, given that the show seems to have a popular following, that it was rescued from death by apparently Jeff Bezos himself.
Sure.
And then for some reason, they're like, yeah, Jeff went to space himself. He's not that interested in your sci-fi by going to space now. And they just sort of dumped it off with 6 episodes at the end here, because it really, I commented to a few people watching with, there's a point at the end of episode 5 which legitimately feels like, all right, you're halfway through the season now. And it's like, nope, there's 1 episode left. Just, yeah, get on with it. And I think for me, the disappointment is it feels like, even though it was nominally allowed to go out on its own terms, it kind of ends with a whimper and not a bang. And I'm bummed, because even though setting aside the difficulties of adapting the last 3 novels in the series, it just felt like this sort of ending of the entire, you know, show deserved more. Like, I really feel like 4 more hours wouldn't have gone amiss in this case. Like, they did a pretty good job with what they had, but they should have had more.
Yeah, and especially introducing all of the Laconian stuff, because not to go into the books, because I know that's for later, yeah. But they're introducing stuff that's really important to the final three books, but it kind of goes nowhere. And so it's
not
like,
important it is.
Yeah, like, why did they do that? Are they... They must be hoping that it's going to be picked up in some form, because I don't see a reason for them to include all of those, not vignettes. I don't see a point of them including that storyline if they're not going to come in later. Because, you know, as my husband and I were watching this, he kept looking at me going like, what is going on? And I was like, oh, well, you know, it's setting things up for later. But if later never comes, like, why? And I don't know. And yeah, like Dan said, it definitely could have used more episodes, in my opinion, because the pacing felt weird. And it was really good. It was so good. But by the time we got to the end of the season, I was kind of left wanting. Not just because it was good, but just because it was like, I feel like there should be more. This does not feel like a series finale in any way to me.
Are we absolutely sure there weren't 4 more hours stuck in like Amazon's X-ray feature somewhere?
Maybe. Well, still couldn't figure out how to navigate that.
Yeah, there
the
is like a 40-minute basically
I know,
bonus.
That's what I was, yeah.
Yeah, so just to people who don't know, because it's easy for you to miss it, especially if you watch it on Apple TV They did shoot what are essentially like webisodes, but they're attached to each episode. It's called One Ship. It's in the X-ray, so you basically have to pause the episodes, and it's one in each episode. And then there's another video inside there that's a, I don't know, 10-minute long little mini episode. So if you're really missing The Expanse, I guess the good news is you may not have seen it all. There's this little extra piece.
I didn't know that.
But you have to like watch it on an iPad or maybe in your web browser you can do it. But you know, some devices support it and some don't, and it's not obvious for any of them. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I found the 5 1 ship shorts. I did not find and was not aware of a 10-minute piece. So
that's what I'm talking to. It's the okay. it's the one ship stuff, which adds up to I don't know how much. 30 minutes, 40 minutes? About, it's a bit.
Not that long.
Okay. Half an hour. Yeah. I don't want to oversell how much is left, but suffice it to say you may have missed something because they didn't tell you about it.
Yeah, but in those things, you know, spoilers for people who have seen all of season 6 but haven't seen those things, but in the mainline story, in the mainline season, there's a reference that if you're paying attention to Christian's health declining. Mm. One of the one-shot shorts is specifically about her health declining. And you don't get that unless you get the shorts or are particularly attentive to the series. This season, in the last few months, 3 of the properties I care about the most, The Expanse, Doctor Who, and Star Wars, have released shortened, compromised seasons of their shows just all at once. It's been a very weird couple of months for me as a TV watcher. And all of the compromises that went into The Expanse season 6 are kind of obvious, but because I haven't read the books, because I know that there's more to the story, but I don't know what that is, I found myself really satisfied by these 6 episodes. I would have liked more of them, but the story was there was the extra stuff on Laconia, but the emotional arc of the season was all about Marco and Aros versus Earth and Mars, and I got what I wanted out of that. And the bits about Laconia, all the way up to the very last shot of the credits before you go into the plane closing credits,
as the camera is moving around the ring, right at the very end, the ring is turning red.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Fade to black. Mm-hmm. That's all you see of it. They've got faith that they're going to be telling more stories. Whether they're going to pick up in 30 actual years from now or what, I don't know. But between the faith that they seem to have that they're going to continue the story, and the fact that these arcs were, that the Marco and Aros arc was really nicely tied off, and the fact that it, even if they don't make another episode of it, I got books to read. I was really satisfied with this season.
Yeah, I went into the last episode being like, there's no, if it wasn't that I had such faith in this show and the showrunners, I was like, oh, this, there's no way they can pull this off. And then I, by the end of that last episode, I think it was a really perfect series finale for me. And I hope they're setting up other stuff, but I think they did such a good job wrapping up the arcs of the people that I cared about, that some of the maybe pieces that I wasn't sure why they'd included in that in this season, it didn't matter in some ways.
Yeah, I think that the, like what Dan was getting at there, I do think there's a pacing problem, because you get this, these series of vignettes on Laconia that don't seem to go anywhere. And if you've read the books, you know where they go, but it also doesn't, you know, it doesn't go anywhere in what the is the run of the show. And it does feel a little bit like the first few episodes are paced to tell a longer story. Like Dan said, it's almost as if you get to the end of episode 5 and you're like, oh, now the big story arc is kicking into gear. And then there's only episode 6. But I agree, Jen, with what you said, that that last episode is pretty great. Like, it was riveting, and you know, it held my attention like a big blockbuster movie would, like, because it was not only, I think, technically competent enough that it was a very exciting kind of actiony space battle-y kind of thing, but that you've got 6 seasons worth of character arcs kind of, and you know you're probably not going to see these characters again. And I think it really delivered. I didn't end up being disappointed by the show's finale as much as I was disappointed that I don't understand why we didn't get more, and I don't understand the fact that they're teasing story elements that don't, that they don't have any ability, at least at this point, to follow up on. That part is what led me scratching my head. Even though I had such a great time, I was so happy to revisit these characters. And, you know, my wife and I were watching this, and we were both really sad when it ended, because it has been a great show and it did have a great ending. But I'm still a little puzzled by the pacing choices and the Laconia choice in particular. And I thought that there would be like a big reveal the day after the show ended, where they said, you see, here was our plan. And as far as I can tell, they haven't said a peep. So
nope.
I don't know.
What a weird choice. Someone made a choice somewhere. I don't know who it was. I mean, I assume this was at the studio level, not at the, you know, the show production level, but you know, somebody out there made a choice to have this be, it almost feels like maybe they were promised something else. And then, you know, 90% of the way through being done with the season, they were like, yeah, we can't actually do that. So just, you know,
keep in mind,
run what you got.
Keep in mind, this was originally a sci-fi show. The producer of it is, what is it? Alcon. It is not owned by Amazon.
Right.
And so that makes a few differences, right? It's not an owned and operated, and it means that they could take it, you know, they could take it somewhere else if they wanted to. They could have other plans for it. It also means that economically, you know, Amazon doesn't like own it kit and caboodle, and so it's got less of a motivator maybe than for stuff that are directly straight up Amazon Studios productions. But yeah, I do wonder, one, if that meant that they didn't get the funding that maybe they wanted to get, and two, if they decided that they were going to kind of obstinately not end it the way that maybe Amazon would have wanted them to end it, because in the end, whether it's the producers or the owners of the rights, who made the show, to say, you know, it'll be over when we say it's over and not when you say it's over. I wonder if there's something going on like that, but still, it's just sort of, it goes out and we're left with this silence of like, well, you seem to be setting up 3 more seasons, but you know, are you, there isn't even a statement of like, well, maybe we'll revisit this in 10 or 15 years, you know, down the road, and we'll tell those last stories. There's just sort of not anything. It's very weird.
Our co-host, Katie Burt, who's also at Den of Geek, has an article where she's collecting some quotes from Naren Shankar and others. And the gist of it appears to be that Amazon said, we're only going to give you this much money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, because we're busy with Lord of the Rings stuff now. You're, you know, this feels like a very Netflix kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. We've gotten all we
elsewhere.
Need out of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Shankar's quoted as saying, the door is open to other things. And if the stars align, I think you'd find a lot of people willing to participate in it. You know, maybe literally 6 seasons and a movie. Maybe something else that is completely funded differently. Alcon's holding all of the cards. All they need is the financial backing.
Right. And I wonder, for those who don't know, this is like a very minor spoiler. It's not even for what happens in the books, but just to say that the first 6 books end at the place more or less that the show ends. Book 7 begins 20 plus years later. And so I wonder if you're a savvy producer who loves The Expanse and you look at how to adapt it, if what you're really playing for here is the idea that this show is loved by a lot of people. The narrative kind of requires a time jump that you maybe could have finessed if you got more money, but you didn't get more money. And so why not park it in a place where you've essentially set up your revival, but and then you just park it and say that at some point in the next 20 years, somebody's going to want to make more Expanse and we'll be there for that moment. And then you walk away. I think that may be the most logical answer to why they chose this path. Not that they have another shoe to drop even, but that they figure it'll probably come back at some point. And until then, we'll just let it sit here.
I think my biggest concern with that is, like, you know, you could say we'll revisit this in 10, 20 years, but it's like, man, you got, what if somebody dies, you know, like, what? Yeah. That's like a bummer, right? Like it's sad if we can't, you know, like regroup with the cast and the characters and stuff that we, you know, have all grown to care about. Like, that's kind of what you're looking for. So it's a risk. It's an interesting, you know, move, but I hope that door does remain open, and there are certainly plenty of places where we've seen properties get revived in the last few, you know, decades even. So
sure.
I think it's well within the realm of possible, but it did surprise me that was how it went out.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So how did everybody feel about the character arcs? Because obviously this is a show about characters as much as it is about, you know, flying around in space and going pew, pew, pew. It is about these people. And, you know, we ended this season having killed off Alex using some, as detailed in a previous episode of The Incomparable, we're using some interesting editing techniques to kill him off after they'd shot the season. But here we've got them trying to kind of like deal with that. And you've got issues with Naomi worrying about her son. There's a whole arc with Philip. Again, I think an interesting choice that the books also make to have us spend time with our villain, Marco, and also look at him through the eyes of his son, who becomes disillusioned with him and kind of starts to understand a little bit more about what his mother was talking about last season, about who his father really is. And then, of course, we've got the other, you know, we've got Bobby and we've got Avasarala and we've got James Holden. And we, you know, we have the usual cast of characters, and they end up in, you know, having their last little chance at some story here. And Amos, of course, everybody's famous as Amos. I didn't even mention him because, you know, everybody gets Amos. Everybody.
In the draft.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Clarissa, I think.
Peaches, yeah.
Peaches, yeah. She gets a good little redemption arc, and I really like that. I like her as a character. I think she's a really powerful agent of change or demonstration that people are capable of change. And sometimes I feel like we aren't. And so it was nice for me, like a little thing like, oh, look at this homicidal maniac who is actually capable of, reconsidering her perspective and changing her mind about things. And that's nice.
Yeah, I like her interactions with the rest of the crew, especially, and like her coming to terms with Holden, right, where they have their couple conversations about like, I wanted to kill you, and I'm just sort of spelling out like where I've come and where I've come from and where I am now. And I agree with Aline. I like her character a lot. I think the actress who plays her is really excellent.
Yeah,
and I thought, because of the fact that, like, we knew they weren't ostensibly anyways doing more seasons or more stories, it also means, a la last season's ending, everybody's fate is kind of up in the air, right? Like, you could diverge from the books at this point and kill off characters who are still alive or what have you. And so there are some real genuine moments of like, well, anything could happen, right? there's a scene towards the end where she, has to fix the reactor. And I'm like, well, maybe she dies heroically saving the crew. I don't know. Like, and it provided some real drama, I thought, too, which was a nice addition. But I thought her character, especially, she was a standout in this season for me.
Well, there were parts of the season where actually I was really frustrated with how much screen time Clarissa gets, just because I wanted to spend more time with some of our more like main Rossi crew. But I think in the end, I did come around to her being there because of kind of her relationship with the Rossi, and particularly Amos.
Yeah.
It made it worthwhile.
Amos, who is, we've seen, I mean, like, he's a monster, but he's our monster. That's always been sort of what it is. And he has a code, but he also sort of needs to find people who tell him what's right and what's wrong. And to see him be parental with her, like, he recognizes that she also is monstrous and has taken some responsibility to bring her on board, and that makes especially Naomi not mm-hmm. impressed. And like that, I agree. I think Clarissa is a fun character, but I think that even if you don't love her taking up screen time, like, every minute she's on screen is also kind of time that accrues to Amos, I think, because it's that relationship is so important, and it is him doing this unusual thing of basically saying, I need to be responsible for her and take care of her and make her part of our crew.
Yeah, this conversation makes me feel very much like Jen and I are in the presence of people who've read the books, because I think all four of us on the Legitimate Salvage podcast team had very little patience for Clarissa until sort of the end. And I just feel like that's possibly part of the richness that you all there's more to the character, because there's more, I'm assuming, of the character.
They spend
a lot
of time in that prison getting out of it and on Earth in the previous season. In the book, they spend a lot of time together. Yeah. And there is a lot of time for their bond to be grown. And in this show, it ends up being shorthanded. But I think you can read, and you can see it especially in the last episode, but the fact that he goes to bat for her and basically says, I brought her on board. Like, it is this like, oh, Amos, I didn't know you had that in you. And that, I think it's kind of fascinating that she's, he is going to bat for her.
Yeah. This is the wild thing about wishing that I could have seen the show through your eyes as book readers, but also glad that I didn't. I'm glad that I was able to engage with it just fresh.
It's always an interesting dichotomy, because I could probably chart the point where I went from thinking these people on screen do not reflect my image of the people in the books, to the point where when I read the books, I pictured the characters from the TV show. Mm-hmm. Like, that is definitely a shift that happened at some point. And, you know, I it took me a long time, you know, watching the show. It took me easily through the first season to get to a point where I was like, all right, I guess these people are kind of reflective of these characters. And you know, after that point, I was sort of on board with like that. And not only that, but like got to the point of identifying them so strongly with those characters that they became, you know, iconically versions of those characters. And so, I enjoyed a lot of what this season had to offer. Again, even with an abbreviated six episodes, there is a lot of time for character relationships to come out. With all of this show, I feel like so much of it is about the characters and the relationships between the characters that is what you always want more of. It's like, hey, I love space battles, but, you know, give me another episode of these characters squaring off across the table from one another or something. And that's always what my priority will be.
And I kind of think this is why last season, I wouldn't say last season fell flat for me, but last season was a little harder for me than this season. It was because Naomi was separated from everybody and we didn't get her. And so I definitely can understand how Clarissa eating up some screen time would be frustrating, because it's kind of detracting from that core relationship or core family that, you know, we love so much, because these characters are so good. The casting is so good. I know initially I was like, I don't know about this. The first season for sure, I was like, these aren't who the people I'm seeing in my head. But now, you know, I'm definitely over that. And much like Dan, when I read the books, it's their voices I hear. It's, you know, they are the embodiment of the characters for me now. But yeah, I completely get it. That it's just for me, for a lot of us, it's about this family. That's what this the story is, and the protomolecule and the science fiction elements are definitely, you know, part of what we love, but that's not the core of it.
I think that, and I've made this comparison enough times on A Legitimate Salvage to really annoy my co-hosts, but I see a lot of parallels between this series and Babylon 5 in the 90s. Both little shows that could, underfunded compared to what they could have used, but building a cult following. In this case, though, that cult following really exploded once it found a home on Amazon, and they weren't limited to sci-fi's budget support or the commercial television structure. The other big difference, aside from, you know, after 30 years, people learn how to write in different ways and take advantage of the medium in different ways, but that family aspect that you're talking about, Aline, is so crucial to what makes me care about this show so much. B5 was never a real family-oriented show. It was more of a space opera and sort of a profile of characters who interrelated very well, but Holden and Amos and Naomi and eventually Clarissa and Bobby, you know, that season... That episode six dinner table scene, the way that Alex would have brought them around the table years before, that simultaneously really warmed my heart. You know, this is my last episode with these characters. Also frightened me, because if they're having this warm family dinner kind of thing, clearly somebody's going to die. I think that's the thing that I value the most about The Expanse, is that it was watching these characters grow and relate to each other.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I really appreciated was that the family interacted with the political and, like, war storylines that were happening. Like, part of what makes this last season so good is the relationship between Naomi and Marco and Holden and Philip and having all of this history and all of those decisions having such weight, and how does that ripple out to the rest of the Rossi? I don't know that I've seen that done so well in a science fiction show.
It's funny, the opinion you have given about Clarissa taking up screen time is sometimes how I feel about Marco. I mean, I enjoy watching him sort of slowly self-destruct, but I just hate him so much. I mean, that's good. He's a well-drawn character that I hate, but I'm like, oh God, I don't want to see this guy with his insane plans go on that much longer.
But Dan, his eyes are so pretty.
They are really
just
pretty.
It's just gorgeous eyes.
I will say I've seen the actor on Twitter. He's very funny, and I appreciate that. But yeah, I think in some ways that I resented the time I spent with them, where I could be spending more time with, the Rossi crew or Avasarala or, somebody else who I just like a little, like, I just don't dislike. But again, it's not a dislike in terms of like the performance or the idea of the character, just like, oh man, he's a bad guy. I don't want to care about the bad guy. But I do think that there are some great storylines with Philip and the way that that's sort of spun out in terms of showing the contrast between, your found family and your biological family and, these lines that get drawn between them. And I thought that the stuff they did with Philip this season was interesting. They gave him a lot of runway, right? Like we have the scene where he kills his best friend. It's heartbreaking because, like, kudos to the actor there too, because I think he really pulls off the horrified, instantly horrified nature of what he's done and trying to cope with it. And the rest of the season is basically him coming to terms with the fact that he did that. And then his relationships later on too with the guy who has the family, the brother on, is it Ceres?
Ceres, yeah.
Ceres, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting insight into, like, hey, maybe this kid is not so bad if he could just get out of this incredibly toxic environment that he lives in.
Yeah, the whole dynamic between those four characters, the battle of wills in the previous season between Naomi and Marco over Philip, over Philip's loyalties, and then Marco simultaneously disparaging and manipulating Philip into being a weapon for him. Holden not being willing to be the guy who kills Naomi's child, and then Naomi being the one to push the button to kill Philip, and then Philip escaping while Marco dissolves in the most glorious villain dissolution I have ever seen. Those four characters right there, that's the heart of the season for me.
Philip, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, in the books, doesn't Philip basically walk off the ship onto a station before they...
I forget. He gets off. Yeah, he does get off, and I can't remember.
This one, I was like, wait a second. Like, how are they going to do that? Are they going to save him? And they do save him by having him jettisoned, basically, out of it. But I think it's a little... It is actually still quite dramatic, but I believe the way it works in the books is that he... they're about to take off for their final confrontation that goes the way it does in the show, and Philip basically walks off the ship and away from his father. But I'm glad that they got the emotional kind of beat of that. I agree, like, Marco is really annoying, and who wants to spend time with Marco? And yeah, dreamy. But but it is important. Like, that is such a key part to Naomi's story as well, to have the villain of the piece is also the father of her child, and he's along for the ride, and so much set up last season when they were together. So to have this moment where Philip sort of starts to figure himself out, it's like, I think it's worth the time. But isn't it interesting we're talking about this again, because there were these six episodes and we feel like time is so precious. You can't waste a second of it on a character that I'm less interested in than the main characters. Speaking of which, Christian Avasarala is one of my favorite things about the show. She doesn't have as much to do this season. I felt kind of bad, but then again, basically she gets to stand in a bunch of rooms and argue with belligerent admirals.
It's already more in some ways than the books, because I, like, they have that bit at the last episode that even I was like calling the scene, like, wait a second, why is the head of your entire government out at the front fighting with people? And they're like, no, you shouldn't be here. And she's like, I'm going to be here. And you're like, yeah, in the books, I don't think she
leaves. I think she's just on the moon the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, you have to have her interacting with these characters, right? Like, it's totally a loss if you don't have her, you know, facing off with Holden or Bobby or what have you. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, so good to watch her. She is my favorite character from the books.
Or the moment when, I think it's in episode 4, when she meets Drummer.
And yeah.
Like, that, mm-hmm. You have to have that moment, I think, to see these two leaders who have come from really different places.
That's the thing, is that moment where they shake hands is the moment where I thought, this feels like halfway through the season.
Uh-huh. Mm,
and it is the end of episode 5, I believe. And I'm like, what? You're only just like bringing these characters together now?
And Drummer, a character who, by the way, is essentially not in the books. I think they're...
She's in the later books because she was so popular on
the show. On the TV show, exactly right.
They added her.
That is such an interesting story because it is the story of somebody who has taken a principled stand against the person who is essentially representing her own people. And so to be the person who says, no, he doesn't represent me, and be potentially branded a traitor, and her family basically is destroyed by this, and she's put everything on the line, risked and lost everything to do what is right. And then to have that moment where you totally understand why. It's like, you know, oh, but Avasarala, come on, she's good. You're going to love her. It's like, no, that doesn't make any sense. Like, this is a this is a huge step that will potentially brand her as a traitor to the belt for forever if it goes wrong. But she also kind of knows that in the end, it's what she has to do. And that's that's one of the nice things about the end of this season, is it really is all the great powers of the solar system saying, the world has changed and we have a common enemy and, you know, things aren't the way they were before and we need to work together. But it is a great, the Drummer's story is so dramatic and tragic. And then ultimately, you know, she's also, after she shakes the hand, she's also out in the middle of it in the final episode, blowing stuff up and trying to kill Marco. So that's all good too.
Christian and Avasarala are basically the same person. Like, they're two sides of the same coin.
Drummer, you mean?
Yeah. Sorry. Like, they are two sides of the same coin. They're the same person. They are principled. They are driven. They're going to get the job done no matter what they need to do and what they need to sacrifice. They put on their armor. For Christian, it is Chrissy, as Amos and I like to call her. at least I call her that to her face. It's her, you know, it's her jewelry, her wardrobe, her makeup. For Drummer, it is her very heavy smoky eye and her stony face. You know, like, they are the same person fighting on two sides and then kind of allied. And I think it's this really interesting dynamic because I feel like they know they can trust each other, but they also can't trust each other because their interests are not exactly the same and they're mm-hmm. going to do what they need to do, you know?
I agree. They are really similar. And I think the core difference is one has and comes from a lot more power.
Yes.
And like, ultimately, it's like, how much power are you going to give up? She's not going to give, you know, Avasarala is not going to give up the amount of power that Drummer wants.
Yeah.
Or that the belt wants. So it's so interesting to see that dynamic.
You know who's going to give up that power is Holden. How about that last scene?
That scene is so good because I saw it coming just before he does it. Like, I was like, oh, I see what he's going to do here. And it's fantastic because it's exactly what needs to happen, right? And you can tell Holden has had those wheels turning ever since that meeting where he agrees to take the job. Like, you know, he's doesn't really think, like, this isn't for me.
The assurances that he is looking for are for one specific thing.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's so, you know, not to put it too much into real world terms that I think, you know, you can run into, but like, In terms of like sort of an allyship sort of situation, I feel like Holden is pretty much sort of embodying that idea. It's like, look, I am not the right person for this job. I'll tell you who is the right person for this job, and I'm going to do everything possible to make sure they get this job.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Oh, you're going to appoint me? Well, then I'll appoint them as my successor, and then I'm out of here. And yeah. And that's such a great moment when Avasaral is so mad at him, and he's like, look, you know how to do that. And she's like, essentially, she's like, yeah, well played. You maybe aren't as dumb and annoying as I thought you were all along, you dumb, annoying man.
Well, and it's the most Holden move of any Holden move that ever Holdened. You know, it's just...
He's a paladin, right? Like, he's a paladin. That's what he does.
Yep. Any other thoughts about the characters in the story of season six? This is a good time to get it out if you've got anything on your list.
That sounds faintly ominous.
I did want to say I feel like I kind of need to go back and rewatch that last episode because that battle scene is super intense, and yet I felt like I missed about 50% of the dialogue because so much is happening, and it's loud, and they're yelling, and like people are getting shot and exploding, and there's just so much going on. It was like really, I agree, it was like blockbuster, but like I also kind of lost track because I was trying to take everything in.
I want to shout out Frankie Adams as Bobby Draper.
Yeah.
And how that character just utterly came into her own. I think that she was better and better every season.
Yeah, she really was.
Mm-hmm. The merc for hire on Mars to the the amazing hero stuff that happened on the ring station,
right?
All the way up to just flying the ship in the end. I think Bobby, she just felt irreplaceable to me, and I was glad that she was around when Cass Anvar left.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, Frankie Adams didn't really have a lot of acting experience when she came into the show, as I recall. And I think it was a tough act to come in and embody this character. And I totally agree with you, Chip. Like, every season, she just seemed more and more like just nailing it. Like, she really brought like an A game to that entire performance. And by the end, I think she's just like, she is more than almost any of the others. Like, just you close your eyes and picture Bobby Draper, and that's who you see.
And it's a credit to the, I don't know if it's the casting director or the showrunners, because I know they had a hard time finding someone who, they kept looking for someone who met the kind of description of her character. And the showrunners really pushed to say, like, there has to be someone out there. Because she'd only done a couple small things in like New Zealand.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine anyone else playing her.
My favorite bits of the season, and also in one of the hidden X-ray one-shot thingies, was seeing her play off of Amos all this season. Basically out-machoing him at just about every turn. and just matter-of-factly, she's not a cartoonish, strong female military character like perhaps Vasky in Aliens. There's a lot more to her, I think, but she more than holds her own against a more traditionally macho character like Amos.
It is a remarkable time. Frankie Adams is actually Samoan, but from New Zealand. But I think my point still holds, which is you have actors of Polynesian descent kicking ass in two major science fiction franchises simultaneously between Bobby Draper and Boba Fett. And I just want to say it's pretty awesome. And also I want to say Frankie Adams, please put her in something else very soon.
Yeah, right.
Might I suggest a Star Trek show, but really I'll take her in anything. She is great. They shoot Star Trek in Toronto. It's right there. They just slide her on over. She's so good, and that's such a great character, and she's embodied it so well. And I know they had trouble casting that character, but they nailed it. They really did. They found somebody who didn't have a lot of experience, but who really grew into it and did a great job.
I'd be fascinated to see her in something non-genre.
I think she can do nothing wrong.
Anything.
Yeah. You just need somebody who's got a show for a big, strong lady like Frankie Adams, but she's so good. Final words, Jeff and Jen, any final, final last words?
I'll repeat, you know, I wish I could simultaneously have read the books and not have read the books, you know, Schrodinger's TV viewer.
Sure.
But I was glad to get the story fresh this way, and mm-hmm. now I'm looking forward to reading the books and learning the rest of the story.
You'll enjoy the divergences just in the opposite way that we enjoyed the divergences. That's all.
mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm excited to read them.
They're good. I mean, that's the thing.
They are legit really great.
They're really good books. They're not, you know, they're not just kind of garbage that was fodder for a TV show. They are, that, like the first book, most of us on The Incomparable read Leviathan Wakes, right? Bookends. Mm-hmm. The bookends, people. Leviathan Wakes, because it was nominated for Best Novel for the Hugo Awards. And so we're like, all right, mm-hmm. we'll read it. And there were, you know, vomit zombies and stuff. And like, what is this book? There's a cop with a hat and vomit zombies. I don't know what I'm reading here. And the answer was, it was the start of this phenomenon that is The Expanse. And they're legitimately very good science fiction novels. You will have a blast, I predict, in reading them. But for now, we must consign you to the deep, because we're going to talk about books 7 through 9.
Chip, you're really spacing?
Chip, what? You were the one who suggested that we space you, so now is the time. Get in the airlock.
Death, but I vow with my every breath, forego with wisdom ways when Chip, I say.
Chip Sutter, thank you for being here.
Can we space him before he finishes singing?
He has to say goodbye first. Chip Sutter, thank you for being here.
Bye.
And Jen Burt, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And they can both be found also on our A Legitimate Salvage podcast. If you love The Expanse and you want to re-watch it, watch it with some podcast companionship on A Legitimate Salvage. But now I press the button. All right, now we should talk about the books a little bit with Chip and Jen gone, just those of us who read all of these books. But yeah, the last three books are
so wild.
They are pretty wild, and I love that about it, that the last trilogy is not only just set in the far future, but there's so many strange things. There's a giant diamond that mm-hmm. has like the thoughts of the previous civilization sort of in it. It's like a database. There's like that last book, it does everything that you want it to, in the sense of it actually kind of resolving the storyline and people fight back. And I did. So in Leviathan Falls, there was a part about halfway through where I was like, oh, I see where this is going. They're going to have to shut it all down. This whole story has been about creating the ring gates and being able to spread humanity out throughout the solar system. And there's a moment in Leviathan Falls where I think, oh, the way you beat the monsters that live in the space that is generated by the ring gates is to turn off the ring gates. Don't be like the old builder civilization. You gotta shut it down. And, you know, being book 9, having it be Holden who sacrifices himself essentially to flip the switch and shut it down. And
again, a very Holden move, in Aline's words, the most Holdening Holden.
Yeah, exactly. And with, of course, the egging on of Miller, basically, as it all happens.
The scene where Holden injects himself with the protomolecule and Miller shows up again, I think I laughed out loud. Like, because it was, as you said, Jason, it's like, yeah, okay, obviously that's where this was going, but still, the fact that they went there and that, you know, you have that moment, that perfect sort of, you know, mirror back to the earlier books, was just delightful. It was just delightful, because mm-hmm. you can't end the series without Miller. Appearing in some way or another.
No, that was the whole beauty of that first book, right? So, yeah.
Yeah.
And it feels, I don't know, it's almost fan servicey, and people say that like it's a bad thing.
Yes.
But
oh yeah,
I am here for the fan service.
Heaven forbid that the people who enjoy the books, enjoy a 9-book series, should be given things that they want to see. We shouldn't allow that to happen.
Yeah,
come on, that's not fan service. That's called creating like bookends in order to bring the story back around and remind you of how it all got started. That's like a piece of art. It's a beautiful thing. really.
I think my biggest struggle with Leviathan Falls, as with it had been so long since book eight, that like,
oh yeah,
I remember the broad strokes of things that had happened, but was trying to like remember details.
Holden was tortured and held prisoner.
Yeah, he was right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, okay. And then Duarte is like comatose and basically dead. Only he's fine and he's teleporting places.
I did remember that part because that was supposed to be like a great victory. That it was like Duarte has become comatose because he's been taken over by the proto molecule. And then in the last thing, basically, that I think happens in Tiamat's Wrath is that he goes to he pops up and Dr. Manhattan like and dissolves the evil scientist, right?
Right. Yeah,
and that's the last, and you're like, what? And so in this book, he is a ghost. He's like Dr. Manhattan. Like, he's like a ghost who appears various places trying to figure out how to solve everything.
And he is a fascinating character. And like, that is one thing, just to make a, you know, reference back to our discussion of the show. The fact that they brought him in seemed just bananas to me.
Right. Like,
this character is so important. And it also, no offense to the guy who played him, but I feel like that's where you want to bring in like a name. Like,
right.
Like, he's such a dynamic, interesting, important character that to have him be a throwaway character who appears in like 5 minutes of like two episodes is like, what are you doing? This guy's like the big bad.
Well, and they're at the wake and what the scientist dude comes in is like, oh my gosh, you have to come. And like, they go running out and Justin looks at me and I say, don't worry, it's important, but you'll learn more about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you read the books, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Very weird choice for them to do all of that. And yet, having read Strange Dogs, I really liked that they put that story in there. And of course, and Dan, you mentioned this in our Slack a while ago. It's like you have that moment because you didn't read Strange Dogs, the novella.
No.
So you're watching the Strange Dogs.
I haven't either.
Oh, okay. Well, so to both of you, you're watching those two kids. And did you ever have that moment where you're like, oh my God, these are the two kids who are pro-molecule
kids? It totally clicked for me at some point. It's like, oh, it's the black-eyed kids.
It's the same kids. Because 20 years later, they're still kids, you see?
Yeah, exactly. That was a freak-out moment. Where like I think I'm watching my wife who has not read any of the books and just watches the show, and it was just like, oh no.
Yeah.
Like, she's like, I think bad things are gonna happen to those kids. I'm like, oh yes,
yes.
Right.
when they introduced her brother, I was like, oh yeah, I know where this is going
right
now.
Yeah.
Although when you talk about in the book series, especially the sort of like proto-molecule modified people, who do not become vomit zombies because they're not being turned into, you know, a thing that's going to go to Venus and make a ring gate. I really liked how these books portrayed the kids and Amos.
Yeah.
Because at some point there's a line about like the substrate or something like that. And basically the idea here is these things are tools, the protomolecule, they're tools. And they were used to reboot these people who had died. And while there is they are kind of running in a virtual machine, but I think the book really feels like the truth is they are still who they are. They're running on a different operating system now underneath it all. But as people, they're still people. And that like Amos is still Amos. Even
right.
Holden
struggles with that a lot,
right.
But he also is convinced that he really is Amos, but he is like, it's unsettling, right?
Right.
The whole thing is, it's weird and creepy, but I kind of still trust him because he's still him.
Yeah. Yeah.
That he's just slower to process, kind of.
Yeah. And has those moments where they're like, where it's like a glitch or something is happening underneath the surface. But ultimately, I mean, I think the books really do want us to believe that they are not like secret monsters who are going to kill us all. They are actually themselves, but they've been transformed by this technology into these kind of weird self-repairing immortal beings. They've taken this leap beyond traditional biology, leading of course to the most amazing conclusion to a book series I have ever read, which is that since the ring gates have closed, they have everybody travel slow path between solar systems, and in 1,000 years time somebody finally makes it to old Earth and they land, and who is there to greet them but Amos, who is still alive and is essentially the leader of Earth now?
Or basically just the, you know, I loved that scene. I thought it was, I did not know how that book was going to end. I did not expect that particular ending, but it totally landed for me because I was delighted. That is the thing. I closed it and I sort of like, it just made me laugh and think like, of course.
Uh-huh.
And it had a little shades of, not to spoil too much for a really old series, but there's in the later Foundation books, there's like a bit
there's a big reveal,
Earth,
yeah.
And there's a character who's still there just hanging out and you're like, oh, well, of course they're still here.
Yeah.
It got me to thinking though, like it's interesting that of all of the crew members of the Rocinante, or really anyone in the galaxy, mm-hmm. that Amos would be the one.
Yeah.
Like,
and the two
the
kids.
The legitimate sociopath would be the one, yeah. who.
I know, right? I mean, it's just, I mean, and I think you're right. If you get to thinking, you're like, how does that work? And it's like, I don't know if we're supposed to take it at that level, or we're really supposed to take it as like Dan said, it's like, what? Of course.
Yeah, no, it was delightful.
It's so
it was great.
Nothing can stop him.
I'm sure he's spent 1,000 years figuring out, you know, who he can get to tell him who not to kill and who to kill and all of that. But I love that. I mean, I also really like that idea, right? That the door is closed, but it's not permanently closed. The ring, humanity is now spread out. So you actually do have a galactic civilization, but everything's going to be done. Communications are going to be done at light speed. And if you actually want to send people to and from, it's going to be regulated by actual laws of physics. And so it's going to be a different thing. And I thought it was almost like an ecological message. You remember that Star Trek The Next Generation episode where they learned that going too fast in warp speed hurts space?
Yes.
It was a little like that, where it's just like, oh yeah, you know, having a ring gate that goes into another universe in order to cut corners here in our universe, it's bad, and the people who live there hate us.
It's like it's like that episode, only that episode, you know, had to deal with like a bunch of stuff that came later, whereas this one it's the end of the series, so they can be like, yeah, we're not going to worry about what the impact is. We're going to wash our hands of this.
Close the door.
As opposed to having to be holden to it for like 3 more seasons and be like, yeah, but like now we still kind of go warp 9.
And how can we beat them? And really, the big question of this whole series is, how do we beat the monsters that destroyed this incredibly advanced civilization that came up with a proto-molecule that did the ring gates, that did all of these things, and they were wiped out. So how can we hope to beat them? And the answer is sort of because...
Like fly underneath the radar,
their
basically.
Hubris... Well, it's the way I read it was their hubris is what killed them, because they didn't think of the one thing to do, which is close the door. Just accept that you're not going to be able to cut corners, close the door, and then it's not going to be a problem. And the humans and James Holden basically are able to make that move and say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we survive. We close the door. It's although with the door closed, nobody can go to the giant diamond and do research, which made me sad.
It did. It also feels almost like setting up for it's almost like this is the pre... not the prequel, but like the sort of the preamble of the like new galactic civilization where people are far flung. Like you could almost picture a series set in that far future time about this new version of the universe.
Or pick your existing favorite far flung human civilization
colony,
in the galaxy who hasn't been in contact with most of the other people in the galaxy for years. Like pick your favorite sci-fi series of that, and this is essentially the origin story of that. I actually had that thought, Dan, which is I know that they said that they're not going to write any Expanse books anymore, but I thought, you know what these guys should do is they should do like a From the Universe of the Expanse series of novels. It's like Star Trek books or something, but it's actually just now we've set up this new scenario when we're not going to play in it, so you all play in it, and I'd read those. I think that might be a lot of fun.
Yeah,
Laconia would be like that that planet in Stargate SG-1 that was like really advanced, where Carter falls in love with that ambassador dude, and then everybody dies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a good one. Don't fall in love with the aliens, by the way. In Stargate,
no, don't do that.
Advice to the Stargate characters, especially don't do it.
I wanted to ask what you guys thought of the new POV character in this book, the villain whose name I'm blanking on, but the woman who's the soldier.
Oh yeah. Oh, I hated her just like I hated Marco.
Yeah, I hate her.
I mean, it's good. It's the same feeling, right? Which is like, mm-hmm. I really hate her and I want her to die and I want her to fail. And there's that moment where Holden shoots her and you're like, yeah, but she doesn't die. And and I am torn because it's sort of like, right, Dan? I mean, you are an author of science fiction novels. The challenge with villains is you want your readers to hate them, but you don't want them to despise them to the point where they don't want them in the book anymore, because then what? So I thought that they walked the line with her where she was really kind of hateful, but then over time you also realize what a wreck of a human being she is, and she's a complete disaster. And by the end, you know, she's not, she kind of is defanged a little bit, because just even though she's awful, like, it doesn't matter by the end how awful she is, but she's awful.
And she's also a really interesting character, and I appreciate how they didn't make her a one-dimensional villain. Like, Marco's kind of one-dimensional. Yeah. He's got his goal and that's it. But with her, it's like, oh, and by the way, pretty good artist, has an art history background, and it's like, all right, that's interesting.
No, she's got a real spin the wheel kind of selection of traits, right? It's almost like going back to this origin of this series as an RPG, because it's like, she's got her particular sexual interests, she's got her art history background, she's got her loyalty to Duarte, which is weird. What a weird character.
She's so interesting in that, like, her fundamentally at the end of the book, it's her distaste for this idea that anybody else could know what's in her head that kind of turns the tide towards the end there.
Because everybody becomes like a big kumbaya.
The hive mind. Yeah. But her distaste for that and like how upset it makes her is kind of what drives her to eventually help stop Duarte. And I thought that was an interesting, like, I kind of realized, like, as they got there, like, oh, this is why she needs to be here for all of this.
Because she gets really freaked out when people remember her memories, right?
Yeah.
She's like, no, I don't want that. And that is the great push and pull at the end here, right? Is the, are we going to follow Duarte and basically, you know, become a hive mind? Or are we going to blow up the ring gates and become individuals again? And that's, I know what side that our characters are on, but... It's I thought it was a lot of fun. I was going to nominate Tiamat's Wrath for our book draft for the best books of the 2010s. I legitimately love that book. I think it's so good. And this was a great capper following on from that to wrap up the series and take it to some interesting places. And like we were saying to Chip and Jen, like, I envy them just as they sort of like are interested in the fact that we saw the show through different eyes. I envy them being able to experience these books because, like we said before, they were unceremoniously spaced. There was a brief ceremony. These are good books. Like, this is a good series. This is not one of those series that, there's 9 books, but it really lets you down. It's like, no, they did a good job. They released them on a good schedule. really strong. I was very impressed with the work that they did, especially while they were like involved in the TV show too, on top of it.
It is more than a little daunting.
Right.
And like,
I still remember. So I read the books because I started the series because Justin told me to. He was like, no, really, you need to read these. I really want your thoughts. At that point, I think there were maybe the first 3 were out, maybe the first 2. And he was like, look, they have these things called the Epstein drives, and this is how it works. And I'm like, this is not the way to appeal to me, but okay, I'll read them because you're super into them. And I was just sucked in. And it has not let me down since. And it's only gotten better because, as I've talked about in previous episodes where we've talked about The Expanse, like, early on, there were no women point of view characters. Mm-hmm. There were hardly any women written in the books. And they have listened, I think, and they have really kind of paid attention to the change of the tides of the world over the last decade, and more women, more diversity in general, racial diversity. I mean, there's polyamory which is not something that's common in mainstream media. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Holden's parents are a group marriage, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And so I love the books for that reason, too. I think that there are it's really a great example of what science fiction does best when it's firing on all cylinders, in that it is telling a good story that is reflective of the time. And it is, they were updating what the story was as society updated its understanding and belief system over the course of the series being written. I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts about this this series and about Leviathan Falls?
I want to mention, I thought that I like the sort of mystery aspect of unraveling, like, what's going on with the whole with the Ringgate aliens shutting off the consciousnesses and like everything, and they're trying to figure out like what is going on, what is happening, how do we stop this. I liked that whole thing being sort of unraveled and explained and explored, because it was like a creepy, it's not like, oh yeah, these aliens, they're gonna come through and start shooting at us. No, they're just gonna turn your minds off. You're gonna die.
They're like,
like, that's weird and creepy.
It's a really nice idea, and something that I think is there's some science that supports this idea. It's the what if their recourse was not to come in through a portal and kill us all. It's to adjust the laws of physics so we die. Like, that was kind of what they're doing. Is they're like, no, we'll just change the laws of physics and you'll go away.
We just need to find the right knob to turn.
To turn,
right?
In your space that makes you not be able to think or act or live, and then we'll do that.
And I wanted to also mention, because although this does play into the books, it also, something I forgot to mention when we were talking about the last scene of the show, I enjoyed in the last season of the show missives from characters from previous seasons.
I have it in my notes here. I think it's really great. They get a message from Prax. They get a message from Elizabeth Mitchell's character. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Elvie, who
is important in the books here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I enjoyed her role in the books always. Like, I think, especially in these last three books, she becomes such a critical character.
Yeah.
I enjoy having her around a lot. So, like, and I mean, we didn't even mention all the other stuff that happens in these last few books, including, like, you know, Bobby Draper going out in a blaze of glory.
Yep.
There's a lot.
As she would. Like, that was Bobby.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That was true to her.
I feel like that was when you're at the end of the series. You know, you can have your people live happily ever after, or you can say, well, no, this person's going to go out in a blaze of glory doing exactly what you'd expect them to do. And so Bobby's death in book 8 is like that.
Yeah.
And Holden's death at Holden's death in book 9 is like that, where he's like, he's doing the right thing.
But then you also get the flip side, which is, of course, Alex is alive in these last three books, and he kind of goes off and lives his life.
Yeah, with his son.
I wanted to talk about that a little bit too, because, and I wasn't sure if it was more appropriate during the TV portion or this portion. I think this portion, because I didn't miss him during the TV show. And I think part of that is because they did a really good job like filling in Bobby. I think part of that was because there weren't a lot of episodes. There was so much time with Clarissa, with Marco, with Philip. But also, like, I kind of feel like Alex doesn't do a whole lot in the last three books.
Yeah, he's got a important role, I think, in terms of his, in some ways, he's always a little bit of the glue that holds the crew together.
Agreed, yeah.
But he's not, like, And I think the show plays a little fast and loose with how easy it is for Holden to just be like, all right, pop in the chair. It's like anybody could do this job, right? Like in the first five seasons, we're told how amazing a pilot Alex is. And there is that great scene in like season 2 or 3 where he has to do all the orbits and like not run the engines. And he's like calculating like all the different places. Like, all right, I'm going to swing through this gravity well and catch this and then go through here. And it's like a really great scene. And like, you're supposed to remember, like, this guy is actually a pretty great pilot. But they kind of throw that all out the window for expediency in season 6, where it's like, I mean, basically anybody can fly the ship.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of allude to it like, right. Oh, yeah, I'm not the pilot Amos or Alex was, but it's not really a
big deal.
Yeah.
They just had to do it. It is funny they're reading the book to know that they killed Alex off in the show, and then here he is, and he survives and gets to go off with his son and his son's wife and their child and be on another planet somewhere, and that's where he's motoring off to at the end and before they close the door.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
It's just a weird, strange, whatever the opposite of a coincidence is, divergence,
yeah. No, it was very, very peculiar. It's true. It's true. But these books were really good. I like all the weird stuff with them submerging the kids in the database with Elvie, and that she kind of loses the plot, and her husband's like, everybody here thinks you've gone crazy, right? And that you're torturing these kids, and like, but the kids like it. Like, no, that doesn't. No, you are experimenting on these kids, and they're going along with it. And then Amos shows up, and he's like, "Yeah, let's do this. Great." What? It's just very evocative, and I mean, that's one of the things about the series that I will remember the most is any show where you've got a bunch of, you know, you got 1,000 planets, and you've got. Just it's the widest of widescreen epics. There's always going to be the titillation of like, we could tell you more, but we won't. But I like, I really like how we get little details throughout. We go to a planet for a book, and we hear about like this this weird thing that's in the solar system, and we just get a sense of the enormity of this. The idea that you couldn't. In fact, there's a passage in book 9 that basically says if you went to every planet. For a week or whatever it is, you could never get to all of them before you die.
Yeah.
And it's such a great like moment of just what we're scale. Showing you is not, you need to understand the scale of humanity having spread out to all these systems. And they also say some of them aren't going to make it. Some of them aren't self-sufficient enough to make it and they're going to die when we close the doors, but we have to do it. But like, I really love that scale and the fact that they embrace the scale and they give you the little tidbits of like, just enough detail for your brain to imagine the enormity of what's behind there without them actually having to paint that. I think that's really artfully done.
And I think that the thing that kept me coming back to the series, and this, you know, ties into kind of with the show and what we were discussing, is fundamentally for me, it is a science fiction series in which the characters are still people. And
yes.
That's what I've always loved about this, is that I've read a lot of science fiction and you read a lot of things where it's like, humans have evolved and they're not even really humans anymore. And they're not really, don't really relate to us. And the characters don't feel like people. They feel like, shadow puppets dropped into a plot so that we can talk about interesting science fictional ideas. I mean, like, you know, Foundation is a key.
Yes.
Like the books. Foundation is a key example of this. It struggles with having real people. But these are real people in these books who are like real characters that are entirely identifiable with as people. They're going through all the same stuff that any of us might go through. I mean, just in a different location, on a different scale sometimes. But that is what made me always just, you know, keep coming back for more, was I love these characters so much. And that's what trumps it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. You know, any good modern novel is going to do that. Now, I mean, there have been some Hugo nominees that don't really match that up, and there are not characters.
Maybe
in
not
those
any
books.
Good novel, but many good novels.
But if you're going to do a good high quality, and that's the thing, is there are space opera-y kind of books out there, including the Expanse series, that recognize that, you know, like. Always the best stories are going to be stories about, I always rolled my eyes when people talked about Star Trek was about the human condition, but it's like, well, yeah, like, what do I care if there's some weird, perfect future humans who are involved with the laws of physics? Like, that's a nice idea and all, but like, how do I get into that? How do I understand and empathize with those characters? And that's usually when the author is like, I'm not interested in empathy. I'm like, okay, goodbye. goodbye. But the Expanse is all about that. I wanted to give a shout out to also the fact that these guys, one of them was like George R. R. Martin's assistant. And I just want to appreciate the fact that these guys watched as their book got successful, got sold, got made into a 6-season TV series. They kept writing. They released their books. The last two weren't quite 1 year at a time, but pretty close. And over the course of 10 years, they did 9 books and they got them all out there. And, you know, When Dan earlier, when you were going to say, I remember when the faces of the actors started like inhabiting the books as I read them. What I thought you were going to say is, I remember when I crossed over that moment in Game of Thrones where the books stopped and I went from being a reader of books to being like everybody else on, who was watching the TV show, having no idea what would happen next. Mm-hmm. And so tip of the cap to these guys for getting to the end and doing it in a timely fashion while they were distracted by their books being turned into TV shows and all of that. Like they show a great deal of discipline and teamwork. And I think it really, I saw an interview with them at one point where they said, it really matters that we're trying to do these a book a year. Like we're really trying to not let the readers down. And I thought, well, you would know.
Yeah, that's tough. It's tough. And these are big, no pun intended, expansive books, and there's a lot to keep track of.
Yeah.
They did a stellar job, really.
Well, stellar, too. Wow. You're all about the sci-fi novel puns there.
That's right.
Anything else before we wrap it up? I'm going to miss Chip and Jen.
I'm sad they had to go.
Out there with David Strathairn. It's tough.
Yep.
Oh, David Strathairn.
So many good actors in this show over time. That's actually one of the things that we should have mentioned during the show wrap-up, which is I am very impressed with the casting of this show because they got some world-class actors. Jared Harris, David Strathairn, and Shura Agdashloo. I mean, she is a world-class actress herself.
Who played Fred?
From The Wire.
From The Wire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's really good. Oh man, the scene where they off him in the show, because he doesn't die until later in the books, I think.
Yeah, well, and he just dies Alex dies in the books. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
That's Chad Coleman is his name, but yeah.
Chad Coleman, yeah. He's great too. Yeah, there is a lot of really great casting in this show. Even I'm surprised in the last season there, although we didn't talk about her, Kathleen Robertson, who was on like 90210 or something. I don't know who plays the Marco's second.
Oh yeah, she was really good.
Oh.
She was like the really capable
trying to rein that man in.
Yes, exactly.
Like a much better leader than Marco. Yeah. Basically.
And he just lets her die, right? Like that's a brutal scene where he's like, "Nah, she's done." And like Philip's like, "Let's get a medic." And Marco's like, "No, we're busy. We're doing other stuff here."
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you follow Marco and Haros.
Yeah, it's a bad idea.
I also really love in the books how Naomi kind of unintentionally becomes like the leader of the resistance. Mm-hmm. So we have Holden is always kind of like the face of not necessarily the resistance, although it does become that. But
he's a symbol.
He's the symbol of all that is good and just in the universe, you know, like, but Naomi is always the one crunching the numbers, doing the data analytics, doing the organization. And I love that in the final, I guess it is the final three books, definitely the last two books, she is actually doing that. She's like, nope, like this is what I am doing. I'm setting up this like clandestine network of buoys and
she does the one thing we tell every tech person never do, which is don't run your own email server.
Yes, yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
Like I just I don't love that for her because it's a lot of work and a lot of pressure, but man, she was good at it. They made her good at it.
Yeah.
Well, and those last moments where she knows that Holden is sacrificing herself, I think it's one of those moments of like this, a long relationship and she's very upset. And yet also he is the man she fell in love with. And he, in some ways he's back because he kind of came back broken from being held on Laconia, and he's doing Holden stuff. And this is what he was when she met him. And so it's this really, I thought, well portrayed, bittersweet, like he's going to die and it's the end of the books for us, but her life continues, right? And it's not for her. But at the same time, it's her acceptance and understanding that this is a thing that has to be done, and that it really, of course, it's going to be him to do it. Because that's like when you bought the ticket, this was written on it, is he was going to do dumb stuff like this. That was, mm-hmm. and she knows it, but it's still so sad, right? Because they've been, at this point, they've been together for whatever, 30 years, 25 years. Yeah, it's good stuff. Good job. Mm-hmm. Good job, guys. Are they writing more books together after this?
I think they are. I think they announced they were doing something together that wasn't this.
Yeah.
But they also, I mean, I know Daniel Abraham has written fantasy series in the past on his own. Tiber, I don't think, has done as much on his own, but I thought they were saying that they were working on something else.
Ty Frank.
And there's, And then there's, I think there's like one more short story, right? Like,
There's
coming in a collection.
There's a novella collection coming out in March that will include one new piece of work that nobody's seen before, that it takes place after Leviathan Falls. So everybody's going to have to buy it just for the one story. And, you know,
marketing. I haven't read any of them, so I can read them all.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that's good. There's a bunch of good. That's the thing. For those who have not read those, buy that collection, because a lot of those stories are really good. And you've seen some of them touched on in the show, which I was always delighted by. But like, they are very good. There's a lot of really good stuff in there. The Churn, talking about the origins of Amos in Baltimore, is especially good. And yeah, Strange Dogs is really weird and creepy, but you've seen it now on the show. All right, well, that wraps up The Expanse for now, I guess. Check in with us in episode 1200 when we'll talk about it coming back or something.
And 30 years from now, Jason, when our flash forward.
When our heirs will talk about it in a hologram. But until then, thanks to Chip Sutterth and Jen Burt for being here before we sent them through the airlock. Dan Morin, thank you for being here.
Now we got that out of the way, we'll grab a few beers and get reacquainted.
And Aline Sims, thank you.
Red Kibble for everyone.
Red Kibble. and thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We will see you next week.